So Thursday, June 24th, 5th, something. Summer, winter time, Australia, Lismore, 2009, more or less. Okay. So the yogi note is a more of a general one. Just realize you're incorporating a skill set here. This is a skill set. It's sort of a 3 or 4 pronged meditation that you're learning. The three prongs are sitting, walking, and daily activities, and the fourth one would be metta. Okay, so some of you have your favorites. You know, every one of you likes sitting or walking or. Some of you have like daily activities. Some of you really dig the metta. But all, in the vipassana, all three are very important. Okay, and you may be naturally drawn to one of them as a preference, and that's fine. That's okay. You know, you may hate all three of them. Rarely do I see loving all three of them, but that's okay. Don't worry about it. Just realize, though, that it is, it's kind of like weight training. If you just worked one muscle, you might have beautiful biceps, but scrawny legs, and you wouldn't make it to the finals of the bodybuilding contest, right? So when you do, if any of you are athletes or any training or anything you've done, you realize you've got to have a balanced skill set. That's all. Just realize what you're doing. Just try to keep the continuity going across. You know, I mean, I was laughing with one yogi, some yogis rush quickly to the meditation hall to be mindful. You know, they're hurrying to the Dhamma talk so they can hear about being mindful. It's a paradox. So, you're all nicely on time, and you know it's all elegant. You know how long it takes you to get from A to B now, and you know if you have a few extra minutes, you can slow down, and if you need to, you can mindfully sort of push the throttle in a little bit. Just keep it in balance. Realize the three of them are important. Yeah, they're like a three-legged stool, you know, and if one of them's weak, it'll topple over. Okay, so tonight I'm going to bring, this is a two-part Dhamma talk. So I warn you, like some of the television, it's going to be continued tomorrow. To be continued. But each of them could be a standalone Dhamma talk. I'm going to speak about the Four Noble Truths. One of the core teachings of Buddhism is the Four Noble Truths. And I'm going to do two a night. So we may get a little detail, hopefully, that means something. Now, the Four Noble Truths derives from a sutta called the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Try to say that with a mouthful of marshmallows. It doesn't matter. It is essentially the Buddha's first, the sermon concerning the Buddha's first gig as a Buddha. After his enlightenment, he gave this very sermon to five ascetics that had been his colleagues before. And essentially, it was just a giving of them the information that only a Buddha could have about the truth of the human quandary, the cause of the human quandary, the path to the solution to the human quandary, and a discussion about the benefits of the solution. Okay. So it's probably one of the most elegant treatises I've seen in my limited little life on the human condition. It's elegant. It's internally consistent. It's universally applicable. It's got all the scholarly stuff you need. And indeed, it has stood up to scholarship and academic inquiry over the last, 2,500 years. Many, many theses, PhD, master's theses, have been written on such as this Four Noble Truths. And it has a very practical application to both a meditator's life and a lay person's life, and for that matter, a Buddhist monk's life. And it's got guidance that'll take you right up to sublime states of understanding. So it's a really quite a multifunctional treatise. It's a fourth noble truth, the Magasacha, the truth of the path of suffering, is a wonderful template for daily living. Just a little, a sort of a right set of activities to do to keep you on the straight and narrow. And it's framed in right action, right speech, right this, not thou shalt not do. It's got a very positive spin to it, which of course appealed to me. The four truths are dukkha satya, which means the truth of suffering. That's a translation we'll discuss in a minute. This particular truth for a yogi, for a meditator, has to be understood, realized, if you will. The second truth, which is samudaya satya, is the truth of the cause of suffering. This particular truth has to be uprooted by a practitioner. Cessation of suffering, which is nirodha satya, which is the same as enlightenment or nirvana or nibbana, whatever, has to be experienced by a yogi, a meditator. And the path, the eightfold path, has to be developed. Okay? So these four noble truths are interconnected in what actually, from a meditator's point of view, they have a very important interconnectedness that I hope to elucidate and bring clarity to you. Now, what I'm going to do, hopefully, you have to be careful when you say what you're going to do, because people keep notes and it's recorded and they'll check you later to see if you did it. But what I'm going to attempt to do is apply the Four Noble Truths to your practice and apply it to daily life. Now, frankly, by applying it to your practice, I'll claim that I'm doing a lot to give you insight into how it works in your daily life. Because, as I've said to many of you, this is a microcosm of your life. What's happening here, all the stuff is a microcosm of your life. What's going on in your little video screen up here is what you've been dealing with for X number of years, up to and including this point. And the realization of that is important. So what applies to this little microcosm you have here? Now, the thing about this practice is it doesn't cause anything. It just uncovers what's already there. So when I say a microcosm, often we're dealing with subterranean stuff, subconscious stuff that informs your life unbeknownst to you. Okay, and is sort of the lodestone that you've been trying to swim with, the concrete brick that you've been trying to do your swimming laps with. Okay, it's been weighing you down, and you may not have even noticed it. Okay, so we're this practice brings that to light in a very safe place, a place you can look at it. With someone who understands what's going on and someone who hopefully can give you context. That's my role. Give you context of what's happening. put it in perspective, you know, cheer you on from the sidelines. Part monk, part cheerleader. No pom-poms. I brought my fan instead. Okay. So, this was the Buddha's first speech, first public appearance. It's a very important one. His second last speech was about the before he died, was about the fourth noble truth. So, you know, your first and last words are probably pretty important. And in fact, they are, and they're profound. So we'll just look at what's going on here. The first noble truth is known as dukkha saccha. Dukkha is a word that the early Pali scholars, when they were trying to translate Pali, which was the language of the Buddha, into English, they rendered dukkha saccha, which was the first noble truth, as the truth of suffering. Okay? Now, that is in fact one flavor of dukkha. But it has cast Buddhism in the early stages, perhaps in the West, especially in the West, as a very gloomy and doomy kind of religion. I mean, who suffers in Oz, eh? I mean, that's why it's called Oz, isn't it? No suffering. No worries. You see, who worries in Oz? Nobody. It's the national anthem. No worries, Matilda, you know? See, I know a little bit about your culture. I've sussed you guys. I've sussed you out. Anyway, at least this is an outsider's view of what we know, so maybe it isn't real. Anyway, dukkha saccha, who suffers in the West, really? I mean, people do. People become paraplegic and, you know, they have tragic accidents. You know, their wife dies next to them in a car accident, blah, blah, blah. But generally, you know, we got 3 squares a day. Comfortable cars to drive around in, nice roads upon which to drive, good infrastructure, good government, reasonably fair government, you know, fair people, fair-minded people. So it's not much suffering, really. You know, so it's hard to be attracted to a philosophy or a religion whose first tenet is the truth of suffering. Hey, I don't want any of that stuff. I'm all right, Jack. I'm happy, and that's the way it should be. Take it from me. I know. And I work very hard at being happy. Really hard, as a matter of fact. I struggle to be happy, actually. Okay, so now you're getting into another rendering of dukkha. When you add in, when you render it in this way, which people whose language is somewhat Pali-based, like Thai and Burmese, when they say dukkha, automatically it's like a pop-up with all these definitions. They know what it means. But, you know, we just have one, suffering. But here's some others. Hard to bear, unsatisfying, difficult, challenging. Huh? Now everyone in the room can nod and say, yeah, life has been, occasionally is hard to bear, difficult, unsatisfying. Huh? We all have to nod now, right? Huh? Even the most fortunate among us will ultimately suffer something. So now when you understand dukkha saccha as the truth of unsatisfactoriness, the truth of hard to bear, the truth of being hard to bear, the truth of all this, then we begin to think, Buddhism is quite universal. It spans everything. It spans the human experience. It deals very elegantly with life on the planet Earth. Does it not? Okay. Now, there's more. Don't go away. There's more. There are 11 specific kinds of dukkha and 3 general. I'll focus mainly on the general kinds of dukkha and give you a little snippets of the other ones. The first general experience of dukkha is dukkha-dukkha, double dukkha, dukkha squared, if you want to get fancy. It is simply the suffering, it means suffering of suffering. It is simply the suffering of having a human body, the suffering that goes with being human. It's the dukkha of being in a dukkha-ridden state. No more, no less. Now, what you're having a direct experience of this, okay? Pain is a good one. That is dukkha-dukkha, first-hand, quality grade A dukkha-dukkha. The mental anguish that goes with it, or is sometimes separate from it, because some of you are experiencing incredible mental anguish, right? And it manifests sometimes in the physical, sometimes it just stays up here screwing around with your practice, you know? That is dukkha-dukkha, the suffering of mental anguish. Or even if it's only just a momentary anger. And so we can examine this dukkha-dukkha in a very real way by bringing mindfulness to it. Okay. So the dukkha-dukkha is obvious on especially this level of practice. And you can really begin to penetrate into it. And what hopefully you'll begin to see, if you're patient and diligent with it, is you will see that this dukkha is in fact as impermanent as anything else. Dukkha is anicca. Dukkha is impermanent. It continues throughout the human life for the second reason, the second noble truth, which we'll talk about in a minute. It's perpetuated by a condition in the human mind, which we'll talk about. Suffering exists because of the second noble truth, which for the third time we'll talk about. You got to really want to hear it now. The third kind of dukkha, or the second kind of general dukkha, is known as Viparinama dukkha. Viparinama dukkha or Viprinama dukkha, depending on whether you're Thai or Burmese. Viparinama dukkha means the dukkha, it's been translated a couple ways, the dukkha of happiness or the dukkha of sudden change. Okay, now, how can happiness have dukkha, you may say? Because when I'm happy, there's no dukkha, baby. Well, there is. Because as soon as the happiness ends, then there's craving for it again. And, you know, rambling around the earthly plane looking for more happiness. Okay? So every wonderful flavor leaves a little message. Call me back. Call me. Give me a call. And that's why it causes suffering. Okay, only because of the second noble truth as well, which we'll talk about in a minute. Okay? So, the dukkha of sudden change is a more dramatic illustration of it. And, you know, a few years ago we had a really good example of Viparinama dukkha. It occurred with the tidal wave that occurred in Varais, the tsunami that buffeted this area. Did Australia get hit by it at all? Not really. It kind of was close, maybe, but it certainly did some damage to the paradise island of Phuket in Thailand, which I visited a month or so after. Feature this. You've gone to have Christmas in a wonderfully tropical place. And for the Swedish people that were there, and I think there were some Aussies there, I'm sure, a bunch of Western people, you know, going to the land of smiles for Christmas. It's paradise there. You wake up every day, it's balmy, It's about, do you guys do Fahrenheit here or Celsius? Okay, 27 degrees, nice, balmy breeze, always, guaranteed, especially that time of year. Just a little cool at night even, no air con. Cool in the morning, balmy in the day, bright, sunny. Thais know how to cook Western food really well. Have anything you want, sit on the beach, have, breakfast the day after Christmas with your family, toast, jam, marmalade even, fresh squeezed orange juice, probably plucked from a plantation just down the road, mangoes, pineapple, fresh, any bacon, eggs, whatever, whatever you want, it's there, you're eating it, yum, 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 sunshine, another day, suddenly the sea draws back, way back off into the horizon. People are kind of thinking, wow, what's this? These Thais have really got this, this is interesting. Really interesting show is about to happen. So people start to wander and look out, and it's withdrawn so quickly that fish were flopping around in the mud. They didn't quite make it out. Okay, fair enough. Some people know what's going to happen and they hightail it out. Some don't. Some are curious. Some see off in the distance a kind of a little bit of a roar. There's a wave coming, mist rolling. Here comes the wave. Oh, body surfing. Wow. Early morning body surfing. That'll be fun. It's coming. It suddenly starts to sound very much like a freight train. It's moving very quickly. People still think it's body surfing time. It comes in, and pretty soon it's pretty obvious. It's a 6-meter tidal wave rushing at the speed, almost, of a relatively quickly moving freight train. There goes your day. It's gone. Paradise, one moment. Chaos, death, suffering in a split. Viparinama dukkha, the dukkha of sudden change. Dramatic, yes, of course. Other sudden changes. You lose your job. Suddenly, one time you're a productive member of society, next time you're out in your ear, next day. The market crash. Half your net worth in your pension plans are gone. Because of some thief at Wall Street who orchestrated the whole damn thing. Okay? You lose a business. Gone. Happiness. You, with a friend, one day, hit by a truck the next. Favorite relative, lunch one day, death the next. Happiness, sadness. Viparinama dukkha. One of the unfortunate travails of being human. There's two of them. Third one, the first two you could agree with, it's, you can intellectually understand. Third one, sankhara dukkha. Now this is the dukkha of the endless arising and disappearing of phenomena. Okay, now that, it's hard to comprehend as a human, a non-meditating human. Because, especially early on in life, these endless arising of events are the stuff of a youthful life. Parties, dates, games, assignments, social engagements, fun, beach, surfing, volleyball, basketball. Just keep bringing it on. Bring it on. Bring it on. In fact, you instead of sankhara dukkha, you could almost call it sankhara sukha. Sukha is the opposite of dukkha. This is happiness. The endless arising of events, the endless summer of parties and dates and new meetings and thrills and romance and spills and fun and, surfing and thinking and blah, 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 blah. Seems like fun. And, in Canada, I'm sure as in here, we're trained early. Every year, a birthday occurs, and you become the star of the day. Cake with money in it, They put money in Canadian cakes. And presents from your friends, and Christmas, the same thing, presents under the tree, you know, real snow on the ground. I couldn't wait for Christmas Day when I was a kid. I couldn't sleep at night because I knew there was going to be a ton of toys, loads of candy, and plenty of food. Okay, so, you know, and so it goes. There's events over and over again, and we fill up the, we have events occurring and occurring and occurring. Well, you know, when you get older, like when I was a layman and Christmas, I liked it. It was okay. Scrambling around to get gifts in busy malls. You know, there was a little broker that seemed to take 20% of what I gave and give it back to me. You'd spend $1,000 in gifts and you only seemed to ever get back $700. You know, someone was taking a cut. It's better to give than receive, I know, but I noticed that. I also noticed, you know, and you'd scramble around and you'd have fun and it'd be a nice day. You'd gorge yourself in turkey and lie around like a boa constrictor that just ate a goat, digesting. Okay. And so it had its, it wasn't such a shiny thing anymore. And my birthday, just another notch on the pole, you know, one step closer to death. Hooray. So, you know, everything kind of loses its sparkle when you've been through the same ringer. Not that life, you know, and so the superficial nature of life loses its sparkle. Hopefully when we get older, or as before we age, we get into the authentic nature of life, which is what this practice is meant to bring for you. Authenticity, so you can live a really rich life of being authentic rather than caught up in the events that are meant to fuel your happiness and your assuagement of the angst of life. So sankhara dukkha is the final one. Now just to give you some other of the specifics, the dukkha of birth, okay, the dukkha of death, the dukkha of grief, lamentation, the dukkha of being separated from those we love or being forced to be with those we don't love. You know, the crabby boss, for example. Okay. All those are some examples of the dukkha, the specific forces of dukkha that play on a human's life. Now, the foundation for this dukkha is basically founded in what are known as the khandhas. Now, the khandhas are one physical phenomena and four mental phenomena. They're called collectively the five aggregates, the five upadana khanda, the aggregates of clinging, craving, clinging essentially. And they work in two distinct ways. They work throughout life as a way of creating silly, stupid suffering, and they work on the long term as a set of processes that cause rebirth. It's the reason we keep coming back. Humans enjoy sensual delight. To engage in sensual delight, you must have a body. You gotta have eyes, nose, ears, tongue, skin. You know, you've gotta have all this, or you can't enjoy the smells, the tastes, the sights, the sounds that you crave to enjoy, i.e., the magpie and granny's cookies. Even the thoughts can be enjoyable. Okay, as lacking in substance as they are, we still really dig them. We really enjoy it. So we take rebirth.